This is Night Call, nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight, 11th graders who can't read, with guest, schoolteacher and author, Mrs. Sunny Decker. Night Call is an open forum. Speak for yourself. Ask your own questions. Call Night Call. Collect from anywhere in North America. From the East and Midwest, call 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. Now, from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. Education is an area that touches just about most of us, collectively as well as individually. And most of us feel that our children are definitely not getting the kind of education we'd like for them to get. And, of course, we've seen that most of the programs that are presently going on, not only in our neighborhoods, but, of course, on the campus, in terms of education, must become more relevant. So on Night Call, we've had many experts on education. We've had the privilege of presenting Mr. Roddy McCoy and George Leonard of Education Ecstasy, as well as Jonathan Kozol, the author of Death at an Early Age. And tonight we're going to talk with Mrs. Sunny Decker. She's a young teacher from Philadelphia who just wrote a book called An Empty Spoon. The book tells of her experiences as a young white teacher in a Philadelphia ghetto school. Now, Mrs. Decker, along with many of our educators, is very disturbed about our school systems. She says, and we quote, "The whole trouble with the institution is that it tells kids they should think and then refuses to tolerate any new ideas," unquote. Instead of a real learning situation with students, she saw a lot of playing with tape recorders and finger paints, and teachers gloating because the kids were relating and socializing and coming to class. This really upset Mrs. Decker, and she says, and again we quote, "You can't just play around when kids can't read a want ad in the newspaper. Making learning fun is a great premise, as long as learning is taking place," again, unquote. So tonight, we'd like to find out from our Night Call listeners how you feel about the education systems in your area. And, of course, we hope to ask Mrs. Decker a number of questions that perhaps will help us to clarify some of the problems facing our children as well as the school systems throughout the country. Mrs. Decker, good evening.
Hi.
And thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Del.
Let's start our conversation, and if it's all right with you, can we call you Sunny?
I'd love it. Please.
All right. Why can't our kids read, and why is it so important for them to know how?
Well, they can't read because nobody's ever taught them. I suppose as a suburbanite, I had a tremendous advantage when I started elementary school because I knew about letters and I knew how to write my name and I was interested in learning to read because I'd seen other people do it. The kids I taught haven't had that advantage, so they're sort of behind the eight ball when they walk into school. And then 9 out of 10 times they're presented with a cute cheerleader type who spends the fall cutting out leaves to paste on the windows and the spring cutting out Easter bunnies. And they get further and further behind until in high school they can't pass an IQ test because they can't read the questions. And you're told that your 16-year-old student is slightly retarded, although he might well be very, very brilliant. He just can't master the system. He's never been taught to work within it.
Well, you came into your school, or I should say as a pupil and then going into school, you came in with certain preparations. So am I assuming then that we're saying that many of these kids do not have or have not had the privilege of having any kind of preparation?
Right. Many of my kids came from homes where parents carried two jobs. There were lots of other children running around. They didn't get the attention they needed. And when they got to first grade, they were busy discovering bathrooms and toilets instead of books. So that they got off to a very slow start, and there just weren't the people around to say, hey, you got to read, you know, and teach them.
Well, I was thinking of the statement that the President Nixon made a few days ago, stating that we should be, well, I don't know if this is the exact quote, but it was to the effect that we should be very, very happy and very delighted and pleased with the quality of education in this country.
That sounds sounds like Nixon, doesn't it?
What is wrong with the quality of education? Where does the problem lie? You know, if we're talking about the credibility gap, most of our middle-aged people, or I should say our young middle-aged people in the 40s, they can think back to the time when they did teach the 3 R's, and now they aren't teaching the 3 R's. This is just a period like of about 20 years. What has happened?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's wrong with education. I know what I found when I got to school. I found that there were very few people equipped to handle the needs of our kids as they existed. They were prepared for some prototypical student that behaved as the curriculum says he's supposed to behave. But they weren't prepared for the realities of the situation. So put in a class with 40 kids who were 15 and couldn't read, they tended to do one of two things. Either they fell back on the old curriculum and handed out copies of Ivanhoe and wasted another year, or they got very involved with a lot of the extremely progressive stuff that's happening and concentrated on what I rather glibly called playing around. I don't want to put it down, because there are an awful lot of people going into the schools who really care and are truly concerned. But I think that teaching a kid to love you or relate to you is not doing him a great service if he can't read the sign on a bus coming down the street. I think that if you accept the fact that kids have not been taught to read, that is the issue. That's what you've got to deal with. And I will admit I didn't deal with it especially well. I didn't really begin to know what I was doing when I blundered into that school. But I was lucky in that I was able to hit on a couple things that would get kids excited. And I found that once they were doing something that they felt was meaningful, they would just teach themselves, and I could just sit back and enjoy myself.
And what were some of these things you did?
Well, when I wanted to teach them to write, I thought that it might be a good idea to have them apply for jobs, because that's what they needed. So instead of writing essays, we answered one ads. When I wanted them to express themselves, and they couldn't write a paragraph, I started a project on Japanese haiku, which, you're familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
Haiku is a very short verse form. It's 15 syllables, 3 lines, not even a sentence. And you are forced to say something in an incredibly short space so that you learn how to pull on all your resources. And instead of presenting it as poetry, which would have turned them all off in a second, I talked about how the samurai soldiers had never been defeated because of their quick wit, not because of their great size. And in order to sharpen their wits, they would invent these word puzzles called haiku. And we worked on them as puzzles. And the things the kids wrote were wonderful, really wonderful. Those were a couple of the things that worked. There were far more that didn't.
Sunday, we're going to ask some of our NYCO listeners to join our conversation tonight. We're going to just remind our listeners once again that we always welcome your calls collected. If you're calling from New York, it's 866-5010. And if you're calling from the East or the Midwest, it's area code 212-749-3311. Or if you're calling from the West, it's area code 212-749-4300. Mrs. Murphy is hearing Night Call over WTMJ. She's calling in from Whitewater, Wisconsin. Mrs. Murphy?
Yes. Sunny, I saw you on television.
You did?
And I enjoyed you very much on the Best of Calmer.
Well, thank you.
Listen, I have, I want to ask you about these IQ tests. What do you think about them?
I think they're ridiculous.
I do, too.
I think that teachers, for a long time, have needed the knowledge of a student's IQ because it makes the teacher feel a little more secure. He can put the kid in a little category and say, now I know how to handle him. I know what his IQ is. It sort of helps the teacher feel more like an authoritarian, which he really isn't in this day and age, I don't think.
Well, I resent it very much because I have one boy that I started reading at 4, and when the kindergarten teacher heard I was teaching him to read, she got very upset and said I was doing the boy a big injustice and he'd be all confused. Well, I stopped, and you know, he was held back in second grade because he could not read.
That's incredible. Well, tells you not to listen to kindergarten teachers.
Well, yes, I've learned from my with my second son. But the thing is, I resent them putting the children in, as you say, these little boxes. And my one son is very good in tests, and the other son is not.
Mm-hmm.
He can do them orally, but he cannot do written tests.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, she'll give him a test and he'll fail it, and she'll give it to him orally, and he'll get 100.
Yeah.
So I just can't see these IQ tests.
Well, I think kids have to be evaluated. I mean,
oh, yes.
No matter what you do in a job or in school, some kind of evaluation must take place. And I think a child should be trained to meet those evaluations. But by the same token, we look to IQ tests as some kind of an enormous answer. And, of course, they're nothing more than a kid's ability to read and psych out the questions.
Well, that's true, and this goes with the child for the rest of its life.
Right.
And this is what I think is so terrible. But anyways, I know there's a lot of other people who do want to talk, and I enjoy your program, Del, very much.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Murphy.
Okay.
Thank
all
you.
Right. Bye.
Sonny, according to the story that was written in the Sunday Bulletin, and you went to a school, to Simon Gratz High School, and of course I'm familiar with it being from Philadelphia, but as Harriet Eldridge has quoted the school or has described the school as a school with the highest crime rate, and of course all of your students were black, but you had no problem in relating to these students. Is that a bit unusual?
I feel very peculiar saying it is, because I really didn't do anything so great. No, I didn't have a problem relating, and no, I didn't have discipline problems in class. And I think that there are some very simple reasons why. One was that I'd never taken the kinds of education courses which teach you that as an administrator or educator or social worker, you're supposed to neutralize all your emotions and simply receive and respond in a very calm manner to everything. Because I wasn't neutral, because I continually exposed myself as a human being who didn't know what in the world I was doing, I think the kids had to respond to me as people. They couldn't label me a teacher type and give me pat answers and behave in pat ways simply because I didn't act the way teacher types acted. If somebody hurt my feelings, I said, all right, you know, you've hurt my feelings. Now what do you want from me? I think that if you can respond with honesty, you get honesty from people.
The students that you had the chance to teach, did you find any students there that had unusual capabilities?
Oh, sure. I could never begin to enumerate. But one boy who called last night, as a matter of fact, from a Job Corps center in Kentucky, has been singled out of this enormous Job Corps center to take counseling work and become a counselor in similar centers all over the country. There's incredible potential, just as there is in any group. You know, you take 4,000 teenagers in a high school, and you're going to find a lot of kids with a lot of ability. It's very hard, unfortunately, to single out that ability because a kid can be in your class for 3 months and you might never get to speak to him privately, you know?
What was your initial reaction when you first began teaching and found out that the group that you were teaching, these were 11th graders, am I right?
Well, 10th, 11th, and 12th.
Well, when you found that this group could not read according to the standard that you thought that they should.
Well, I was pretty lost. I didn't know where to begin because I didn't know how to teach reading. I didn't know how to help them. And in the meantime, I was being swamped with clerical work, and all the secretaries in the office were demanding pink forms and yellow forms and white forms. So I was really just trying to keep my head above water and make the class interesting enough so the kids would come back the next day. I don't really know if I did anything constructive as far as reading was concerned for many kids. But I think that there were a few instances in which I was able to excite them enough that they would pursue it on their own. I found lying to my students a great device. You know, they have to prove that you're wrong. And they resort to things as exciting as going to the library, you know, which one kid did for the first time in his life, simply because he had to find out
that what I was saying wasn't true, and he had to prove it.
Now, the question of whether or not teachers or white teachers can teach in the black community, or that black children, if they can relate to white teachers, you have proven that this is possible.
Well, sure, it's possible for one human being to relate to another, but what those kids needed wasn't me. Those kids needed the one thing that most of them always lacked. They needed a strong, positive black male image to respect and to emulate. And if we could populate inner city schools with that thing, you know, I don't believe in segregation, but this is the situation we have created for ourselves. We've created a bunch of kids who are missing this one important thing and need it in order for them to have the hope that possibly they can do something with their lives. So I think that if you're going to deal with a situation, you have to give them what they need. And what they need is great black male teachers. But in lieu of that, and unfortunately there are not enough, I guess I'm better than some pretentious dummy who just walks in and gets the job because she happens to be black, you know?
This is Nicole in New York, and tonight our conversation with Mrs. Sunny Decker is 11th graders who can't read. Mrs. Decker is calling in from Philadelphia. We'll return following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Sunny Decker after station identification. Night Call welcomes your comments about this nationwide listener call-in program. Your opinions and reactions are of value to the producers of Night Call in their continuing attempt to initiate and stimulate dialogue between the black man in the street and his white counterpart. Please address your comments to Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. The producers of Night Call attempt to balance the points of view presented on this series about controversial issues. In keeping with this traditional concern for free expression on controversial matters, Night Call invites requests for equal time from responsible representatives on opposing points of view if it's thought they have not been adequately represented on the air. Such requests should be addressed to Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. Speak for yourself from anywhere in North America to guest school teacher Mrs. Sunny Decker about education in ghetto schools. Night Call collect from the East and Midwest on 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
Out to Savannah, Georgia, Mr. Hales is hearing Night Call over WSOK. Mr. Hales?
Hello, Miss Decker.
Hello.
I'm pleased to meet you, and, I want to ask you, whose fault is it that you think 11th graders can't read?
Whose fault is it?
Whose fault is it? My God, where do you begin? I don't know. I guess it's partly the kid himself for not having the motivation to direct himself regardless of the lousy environment he might live in. And it's partly the teachers who have allowed him to slide through to the 11th grade without teaching him. And it's partly a home where he's never seen a book and where people have not had the made the time to see to it that this kid has some direction. You know, I guess also it's a society that proves to him that you can make just as much money without a high school diploma as you can with one. You know, what's the use of trying?
This is it. Why do you think the teachers that the students get from all the way from first grade up to 11th grade, and how in the first place could he get up to the 11th grade, which is where he knows he can't read, and how could he pass?
Well, they pass because no teacher wants the same lousy kid the second year.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
In other words, he just come to school and just sit up and just pass anything and just get a grade for it.
Yeah. Well, it's not just public schools. I found the student teachers that I met in college had simply to put in time in order to become
qualified as teachers. There are no qualifications for becoming a teacher. At least in Pennsylvania there aren't. I never knew any student teacher who failed his course. You show up for a certain number of hours and you graduate from college and plonk, you're a teacher. I suppose if there were stringent requirements, we might turn teaching into a profession instead of a labor union, and you might have people in elementary schools who cared enough and were competent enough that kids wouldn't wind up in high school in the state they are today.
Well, I think a teacher is less than a teacher if she can let, a student pass and get all the way up to 11th grade and spend all, just practically half his life, going up to 11th grade and can't know how to read.
You're very right.
And I think something should be done about it.
Well, what are we going to do?
I think it's the Board of Education, something got to be done with it. Because in the first place, they should, the exams, what the kids take, they ought to know who can read and who can't read.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's what I think about it.
Yeah.
Mr. Hales, thank you for calling, sir.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Out to Livingston, Montana, Mr. Baskovich is hearing Night Call over KBMN. Mr. Baskovich?
Yeah, don't you think that retarded children would do better if they're in with the regular children and just help rather than being in a separate class?
Well, I hope, first of all, you haven't misunderstood. I wasn't talking about retarded children, right?
Oh,
I agreed on that? I was talking about kids who perhaps had an IQ of 130 when they were 6 years old, but because they can't read the test, have a score of perhaps 70 or 80 by the time they're 15, which is obviously no record of their IQ. It's just a record of their inability to read. But to answer your question, I heard that discussed on Philadelphia television yesterday or today, I think. I always had the feeling that if I had a child who was retarded, I wouldn't want him to be in a class with normal children. I think, first of all, children can be very cruel. And secondly, I don't know how much incentive a retarded child would have to compete if he knew it was a losing battle. Because you have to, if there are 20 normal kids and 5 retarded kids, they have to be, they are in competition with normal kids on their standards, What do you think?
Well, I think if they were helped individually by the teacher more than the other kids, it would work out a lot better.
Well, I think that's very possible if you have a class of 10 or 15.
Yeah.
But when you have a class with 46 on roll and your class day is 40 minutes long, there's very little individual attention that you can give.
Thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. From Rochester, New York, Mr. Thomas is hearing Night Call. Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening, sir. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Your question?
Bill Shield.
Yes, sir.
Pardon me.
That's all right.
I'm sitting here listening to you, and it's very interesting because I'm from the Philadelphia area, and I remember you when you were there in Jazz at Home Club.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I wonder what happened to you, so now I hear from you.
Well, I've been in New York now for a year.
Yes, I know. This young lady is quite the interesting character. I think we need more people like her, not only just in the Philadelphia school system, but in school systems around the country.
But she's left teaching.
She has left teaching. Oh, that's pathetic.
Only for the most mercenary and selfish reasons, I'm afraid.
She must have gotten married. Nevertheless, Simon Gratz is a school I'm familiar with because the area that the school is located in, I once lived. And the kids there are somewhat the ruffians, quite to the contrary, but nevertheless, that's because of the interest that's taken in them. I have one question to pose. That is, why is it that the Philadelphia school system, since I'm not in the educational system there, why is it that there, seemingly, the interest isn't shown toward the students? Like I heard a comment a few minutes ago about why is it that students can't read by the time they reach the 11th grade in school? I think I know a few of the answers, but nevertheless, that's neither here nor there. Are not really important, not found really by any facts. I'm of the opinion that not only do the teachers don't have the motivation or the interest, but neither the parents. I feel for a child to be passed from one grade to another without truly benefiting from class to class and from grade to grade, I've been of the opinion, simply because that a lot of graduates that I encountered, largely coming from grads in the area of employment, that it was production, you know, like factory kids would turn out and they had no ability to read and comprehend. Half of them couldn't spell the name of the school properly, the name of the street that it was located on, and they couldn't spell, believe it or not, Gretz High School properly.
Well, Sonny had offered earlier in the program the fact that you have to kind of share the responsibility on this among the parents and the students as well as the teachers. It's kind of a combined force there. That it's kind of difficult just to single out just one particular person. And I think that if we talk about the Philadelphia system, I think we might as well talk about all of the systems. I don't know if Sonny is able to give us any information about the other systems, but from what we have gathered from this microphone and people we've talked about, all systems just about in the same situation. But the point that I would like to stress is that very interesting one that Sonny offered, in the fact that most parents are involved with two jobs and in some instances three jobs. Why is it, Sonny, if you can answer this, why is it that the parents no longer seem to be able to assist the children in their studies or seem to be interested? Is it possible that the studies are a little bit beyond the parents' comprehension, or what?
Well, I don't think that helping with the studies per se is as much as a parent can do. I think that a lot of the parents are terribly intimidated by the school establishment. And when they find that their kid is having a different substitute every week, or they find that their kid has a class and doesn't have any books in that class, they're afraid to go to the school. They're afraid to approach the teacher because in many instances they've gotten rotten treatment. A counselor that I knew once spoke to a woman and said, you know, the trouble with you people is, this is what people are afraid of. If a parent herself can't read and feels that the teacher is some kind of super intellectual, the parent is very hesitant to go to school and try to press for changes or for effective education. The parent's just as hung up as the kid is in many instances.
I agree with that. Del.
Yes.
I have one other question, which is really not in the form of a question, but a general statement from what I've viewed and over the past years, and I've taken quite an interest in this because I know one day I'd like to have a child to rear and send to public schools, and I've heard, you know, comments pro and con. Well, I wouldn't have my kid in a public school. I have friends who have their children in private schools. Nevertheless, I feel some of the best citizens, some of the best of educated black minds come out of the ghetto area. That's only because this kid has some self-initiative or self-motivation, or he has something to stimulate his interest and make him want to prosper and aggress to the point that he can, you know, get the most out of school and go on to a reputable college or to a college and or what have you, get into the mainstream of American life. But what I find most disgusting in Philadelphia, or as a matter of fact in the larger cities period, is the fact that in these areas, the so-called ghetto areas, the schools are not equipped. Not only are they not equipped to handle the bulk of children attending them, but also the condition of the schools.
Can I interrupt you here? You're saying an awful lot of things that just don't ring true to me at all.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you one example. There's an elementary school at 29th and Allegheny. Do you know what it looks like? An army barrack.
Yeah, but the thing
is, they have kids bussed in there, aside from the ones who live in the neighborhood, and that area is heavily populated. And let me tell you, I've been in Philadelphia for a period of 10 years, and do you know all the addition I've seen to that is other barracks, where in the back of it was a football field, and on the west side of that is a graveyard.
Okay, I will grant you.
And right back of there is SPCA, and they haven't did a thing to, and believe you me, I don't have a child to send to a school, but this is only looking at it as a single individual.
Right. There are lousy school buildings,
believe
and there are
and
nice ones.
And when you compare, I had this debate once with a Jewish individual who said, I don't see why black kids can't.
Mr. Thomas, I'm going to ask you to hold for just a moment. We're going to break for station identification, and then we'll come right back. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Sonny Decker after station identification. Listen to the voices of Night Call.
We're trying to bring about change in this nation through nonviolent channels. Now, if we cannot do it through nonviolence, there are other forces that are going to lead people down a violent path, and the nation will be destroyed.
Ralph Abernathy on apathy and violence, and a white industrialist says jobs will save us from a racial inferno.
It's better to learn and earn than to burn, baby, burn. Now, these are the changes in attitude that spring from the community as a whole to try to work with these people, not just work on them, and to have industry reach into the area and try to recruit and hire the guy that's qualified and to get the other fellow to take training so he, too, can get a job.
Speak for yourself on Night Call. Speak for yourself from anywhere in North America to guest school teacher Mrs. Sonny Decker about education in ghetto schools. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
Mr. Thomas,
yes.
You were making a complaint or offering a complaint about the conditions of a certain school that you knew about in Philadelphia. All right, we're going to ask Sonny now to respond to you.
Yeah, I'm itching to say things.
I am too, because I really hadn't finished.
Well, please finish, and then I'll open
my
mouth.
Very good. I really appreciate that. I was sitting here thinking just then of a conversation that took place one evening between a middle-aged Jewish woman of whom I would consider to be in the middle class. Okay, the comment arose, she made the statement that I don't see why black kids cannot get and receive the education that, say, my children have. This woman lives in Jenkintown. She has a business, I'd say, that grosses over $150,000 a year. She drives a car, and her two teenage daughters have cars. I would say the home that they live in costs approximately $40,000-$50,000. This, in comparison to a ghetto child whose parents' income, the chances are that 9 times out of 10, the average black child is without a father going to school. Number one. Chances are, if the father is in the household, the earning capacity between he and his wife would not exceed $6,000 or maybe $7,000, if that. Chances are here again that that's a very large family. Chances are here again, this kid does not live in an environment that's conducive, generally, to a good upbringing. There are all kinds of factors of which I understand, and you understand nothing, John Q. Public understands, but nevertheless, take the average black ghetto child going to school in the morning. First of all, he gets up hungry 9 times out of 10. Going to school, he's partially, if not shabbily dressed, 9 times out of 10. He walks into a classroom where there are 50 kids screaming, and this is general, around Philadelphia in the areas that are predominantly black, as opposed to the schools where classrooms are composed of, say, maybe between 20 and 30 students at the most. Here's one teacher who recently graduated from college who really doesn't have a hold of the situation of teaching kids in the palm of her hands from the very beginning. So she's frustrated because the size of her class, number one, is overcrowded. Number two, the kids aren't disciplined. Number three, the kids wouldn't know what discipline was if it was given to them. Hold your point right there. One second. Number two.
Number four.
No, all right, number four. We can make it 4, 5, 10, 20. Nevertheless, the psychological thought of a ghetto child as opposed to that child who lives in the suburbs or the areas, say, like northeast, that's considered suburban to me somewhat, is altogether different. The crime rate in the ghetto is higher, so therefore the kid doesn't have too very much to draw on. His parents, 9 times out of 10, are not high school graduates. So here again, he doesn't have the element of psychological thinking around him that would prompt him to aspire to be something great.
All right, Mr. Thomas, let's allow Sonny to respond, okay?
Okay.
All right, Sonny.
Mr. Thomas.
Yes.
I really couldn't care about an example of some $150,000 a year culturally deprived suburbanite and what she thinks. I think the scary thing is to hear somebody like you, who purport to know something about these conditions, paint them in such generalities that the whole situation is distorted beyond belief.
You don't think this
and
is
the kids
general?
Are distorted beyond belief. I will address myself to points you've made one by one. You started out 15 minutes ago by saying my kids were a bunch of ruffians. There are kids to whom survival from day to day, physical survival, is an enormous problem. There are just as many kids who care for younger brothers and sisters, for children of their own, who work all night, who play violin, who play guitar, who take karate lessons, and who try very hard. You said they come to school hungry. There are truly some hungry children in this country. More often than not, my kids missed their first period class because they were in the corner drugstore eating meatball sandwiches and drinking Coca-Cola. They were not hungry. They were also far better dressed than I ever was. I used to look like I was going to a stick fight compared to my kids. Now, there is good reason for their being dressed this well. They were insecure about their homes. They were insecure about their background.
Right,
the image they showed
that.
The world was very important to them.
Right.
But the point is, you are creating such a sob story. You are making them into such a bunch of undisciplined, starving waifs that you're robbing them of any dignity and any humanity, which they deserve.
No, the thing that I'm really trying to get around to is that this country spends billions of dollars overseas in a war that the average fighting man knows not what he's defending his country for. Nevertheless, we stand up for the American flag. Hooray and bravo.
Well, we all know this.
We spend billions of dollars sending spaceships to the moon.
Listen, I don't like the Apollo program either, but you're not saying anything that people are not aware of. The thing that frightens me is that what you are saying, what you say that you understand, you are misrepresenting terribly. I never once had a class of 50 screaming kids, and I never heard a class of 50 screaming kids in a high school of 4,000.
Well, I think basically, I was thinking on the level of elementary rather than high school.
Well, I don't know.
Well, Mr. Thomas, may I just add this point, and then I want to take some other calls. I live in the Philadelphia area, and I suppose you might say that I live in a low-middle-class ghetto. And I can definitely accuse most of my neighbors, and I hope they don't turn this out tonight, of being totally indifferent to the problems of the kids. My wife attends the homeschool association meetings and whatnot, and I would say if we live on a street where perhaps there are about 50 families, and you're lucky if you find two families or two representatives of families at these various meetings. And there is not the concern, and this has nothing to do with if you're going to talk about the ghetto situation, but where these people are homeowners and they have their automobiles and the wall-to-wall carpeting and everything else that is supposed to be the needed comforts. But there is little or no concern on on the behalf of the children. And I think that, again, as Sonny offered in the first half of the program, in terms of the responsibility, you know, I think the parents have something to do with this. So you go into the homes and you don't see anything except a daily newspaper. You do not find the books. You do not find the interest there. The kids are glued to the television sets, and there is just is no interest at all being displayed by the parents. Now, I think also we all are aware of the system. We all are aware of the problems that are there. But it would seem to me that if more parents were interested, certainly I remember going to school at the time when I had to, like, you know, exchange pants with my next-door neighbor because we didn't have enough to go around. But there was an interest displayed in the home to motivate you to learn and motivate you to try to become something. And I think that we've got to kind of think in terms of the responsibilities of the of these parents who are not really doing the job that is necessary. You know, the system doesn't say that you cannot have a book in your home. The system does not say that you should not buy a set of encyclopedias. The system does not say that you not at least to have some kind of take some kind of interest in your kids. And as Sonny has already said, that even in her classes where these kids may have been culturally deprived, there were students who had tremendous aptitudes and tremendous abilities. It's just a matter of somebody working with them and helping to develop it.
But I
thank you for calling, because you've been on for 15 minutes.
I would really like to talk further. I really like to talk to her further. I like to talk to you further.
Well, I want to be fair, because you know we're on a nationwide hookup, and we want to give a chance to everybody. I thank you for calling, sir.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so very much, sir. Thank you. Out in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Mrs. Mars is hearing Night Call over WTMJ. Mrs. Mars?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening to you. It's a wonderful program.
Thank you, ma'am.
I would like to address myself to Sonny Decker's question to a previous caller there. And her question was, well, what can we do about it? Sonny, you must have some answers. You seem to be doing a pretty good job. I've just jotted down a few suggestions here as they came to me. For one thing, I think we know a lot better than we do. In other words, we know about the development of children, and we realize there are certain times in their lives that the introduction of certain learning is more effective. I'm referring here to the Montessori method.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if this wouldn't be one approach.
Well, of course, I think it's very important, and it seems to work beautifully on my nephew, at least.
Sure.
But I'm so overwhelmed by the scale of the problem. It's one thing in a suburban community when 25 mothers support a Montessori school, but when there are millions and millions of people in cities, you can't talk about Montessoris until there's a complete turnover in government or some of the powers that be.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, you know, what can you do? Where can you start?
I'll tell you where I'd start, and I'm, you know, I don't have any answers, but I'm very excited about one idea, which I'm sure will never come to fruition because it's much too sensible. But I think if all the inner city schools were closed today, and teachers, over the course of the summer, were instructed in modern reading techniques, which do work, which are scientific. You don't need to be an artist. You simply need to learn to administer. I think if schools were opened in September and for 1 year taught nothing but reading, an enormous part of the problem would be taken care of. It seemed to me that children who become discipline problems, by and large, are operating outside of socially acceptable lines because they haven't been able to succeed within them. And I discovered in my classes that if I let a kid succeed at one little thing, he'd begin to have fun learning, and he might attempt something a little more difficult. He might try himself.
Right.
But they need the groundwork, and they're not going to get it by teaching biology from books that kids can't read.
Right, and I'd match that with a cutting out a lot of the clerical paperwork, the routine testing that goes on by people who are described as guidance counselors.
Yeah.
Who are so up to their necks in paper that they never can really see a child or understand.
It's not just the guidance counselors. You know, I dropped out of graduate school shortly before I was to get a master's degree because I had enrolled in a reading course. And after the eighth week of the course, the teacher had done nothing but explain testing methods and how to evaluate those tests.
Well,
you know, not a word about how to teach reading.
Right, right.
And this is the kind of thing you get hit with.
Right. And files are full of those tests.
Right.
That's for sure.
And they sure don't mean much.
Right.
Mrs. Mars, thank you for calling, ma'am.
All right, thank you.
11th graders who can't read is our conversation tonight on Night Call. Our guest calling in from Philadelphia is Mrs. Sunny Decker, and she's the author of An Empty Spoon. We return following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Sunny Decker after station identification.
The year 2000 is a little more than a generation away. For our cities, the question is precisely this. Will the new millennium mark a celebration or a wake? If you think you can sit snug in a suburban split level while the cities slide downhill, you're only kidding yourself. Slums won't stop at the city line any more than commuters do. What happens to our cities happens to our suburbs. Together, we can remake our cities. We will. We must. If you think there's nothing you can do to help, think harder.
Send for the free booklet, The Turning Point. Write Night Call, Pomona, New York. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York. Speak for yourself from anywhere in North America to guest school teacher Mrs. Sunny Decker about education in ghetto schools. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
Sonny, not to digress completely away from our conversation tonight, but I was wondering that the inability of kids who can't read, whether this might be one of the reasons for the increase in drugs among youngsters. Have you had any experience along that line?
All my experience with drugs has been in the suburbs and at college. And all those kids can read. So I don't know whether it's a function of their inability to read or a function of an awful lot of money being thrown around.
But in your high school, in the high school you taught in, there was not a drug problem?
Well, the drug circulation that I was aware of was running through the group of rather sophisticated kids who were moving on to bigger things. They were coming to Center City, and they were getting active in the movements. And they were the exciting dissidents in school. The general populace was still drinking wine every Friday night and dancing up a storm. So as far as I was concerned, there wasn't a drug problem. I really couldn't care less if a kid's smoking pot. I do care whether he's running away from his failures to such an extent that he can't think an intelligent thought anymore because he's always so blotto. But I really can't get too excited about it all.
Let's go out to Des Moines, Iowa. Mrs. Benedict is hearing Night Call over KRNT. Mrs. Benedict?
In response to the the gentleman who was wondering if there isn't something that parents could do or if they just aren't interested, my brother had this reading problem, and at age 15, he was reading at approximately a first grade level. I was at that time at Drake University here in Des Moines, and through the education department, I ran across a series of books from Harwagner Publishing Company, and at that time they had two. One was called the Deep Sea Adventure Series, and the other one was a Mystery Series. And these books are absolutely fascinating. They aren't Dickensian-type books, but they dealt with, the sea diving and mysteries where you couldn't really guess what was going to happen. And they were written in such an interesting manner and with such a simple vocabulary and words with which a child might not be familiar. were introduced in such a way that they could almost guess what they were. And these were presented again and again through the story, and at the same time adding new words. And 2 years ago, Har Wagner introduced 5 more series. There's one on racing, which is absolutely fascinating. Also, it's called the Checkered Flag series. And then they proceeded into social science, which they had about 10 books. And they also had them in English and even in foreign languages. And I worked an entire summer with my brother. And at the end of the summer, his reading level had jumped 4 grades through the use of these books. And to anyone who is interested, who has a child in the family with this problem, it's something that anybody can pick up. I was not an education major. I took the classes to see if there wasn't something that I could do, because the teachers apparently couldn't cope with his particular reading problem. And it turned out to be one of simply not being interested in the material.
Sonny, are you familiar with these books?
No, I'm not. They sound great.
Now, are you saying that just the mere the task or... Hello?
Yes.
Yes, that the fact of giving your brother the books and having him to read them and reread them, this added to his reading level?
Yes. The books are interesting.
Is she not there?
Hello?
Yes, he's on the line, Sonny.
Oh, yes. Now, an instruction book does come with these. And as I said, it's something that anyone can pick up. They're terribly elementary, but they're interesting even to an adult. My parents read them, and several of my brother's friends who had similar difficulties read them. And they were all intrigued, and probably for the first time in their lives, picked up a book voluntarily. And I think...
Now, the names of these books again?
They are published by Har Wagner Publishing Company.
Har Wagner.
Har Wagner, right. They publish many school texts, and this is a special series for special education.
All right, Mrs. Benedict, we want to thank you so very much.
Surely. I hope this is profitable to someone listening.
Thank you for calling, ma'am.
Surely.
Thank you. Out to St. Johnsville, New York, Mr. Is it Malpe? He's hearing Night Call over WRUN. Mr. Malpe?
Good evening, Del.
Good evening, sir. How are you feeling?
Thank you. We got an excellent program.
Thank you, sir.
I'd like to speak a little word to Miss Decker in defense of IQ tests.
In defense of IQ tests?
Yes.
All right.
First of all, there are certain IQ tests that don't require a child to read at all. And normally speaking, most reputable psychologists, if a child gets a very bad mark on a reading type IQ test, will check that with a non-reading type IQ test. And beyond that, usually before any important decisions are made, a child is given an individual IQ test. Are you aware of this?
Well, I'm aware of that in schools where psychologists are called in and decisions are made. You see, I'm working in a system where there are no decisions. It doesn't matter what a kid gets on an IQ test. He stays in the same class. And it doesn't matter what dangers are suggested in his scores. Nobody ever looks at them. You see, where individual counseling and individual work is available, these are great, do a great service to teachers and to students alike. But we were not availed of such things.
Well, I think most publishers of the test would generally say that if they're not going to be properly used, they shouldn't be used at all.
Well, you see, properly used can be interpreted with great latitude. And most teachers seem to think that to use a test properly means you start it at a given moment and end it at the prescribed time. And then everything is being done properly.
Mr. Malpe, thank you for calling. Thank you for calling, sir. A local caller from New York City, Mr. Hanner, is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Mr. Hanner?
Yes, Del. I've been listening to the program now for about a year, and we've been getting into an area in which I believe, what's the teacher that's calling in tonight?
Sonny Decker.
Miss Decker.
Right.
I have the basic idea. It's the magnitude of the problem that creates the whole gist of it.
That's it.
The people who are trying to relate to the problem are thinking of it on an individual basis. And individually, it can be corrected.
Exactly.
But with the magnitude in which it would be so radical, it would take such a radical solution in order to undo what has been done. We're speaking of kids that are in the 11th grade that can't read. Now, we can assume that they've been in school now for 11 years. And we're going to try to undo something for 11 years. And one more year? It's impossible. You had Miss Finesse Grant when she was on the President Council Economic Office. And she stated that the people who need the assistance in this particular area, they're not listening to the program because I talk to them in my daily encounters in life. I try to recommend that they listen to the program. The people who listen to the program have a pretty good idea of what's going on. But if we can only, if it was possible that those that could, that need the assistance, like the books that were just recommended by the young lady from out Midwest, I believe it was. Beautiful. The people who listen to this program, they have encyclopedias. They are the ones that encourage their children. Because they have enough. They can't be watching television because the problem is that there's too much time spent in the front of televisions. And if they can't watch, listen to this program and watch television at the same time. So
you're not saying that we're not needed, are you?
Oh no. But the thing about it, if you realize the magnitude of the problem, even trying to get people who really need this program to listen. It's disparaging. It's really disparaging because, number one, and I'll conclude by saying this, the parent, let's say even if it's a fatherless home, the influence of the mother, which her experience could be termed as not adequate, has a tremendous influence, and there's a, you know, what mother does, what the daughter does, or what the child does. And they influence them in the opposite direction, not deliberately, but just the mere action. Like, if a mother's working hard, the child would assume at an early age that more than likely when I become an adult, I will probably have to work also, because this is a trend of life. And the child would try to achieve the same thing. Now, try to undo this influence. It's at an age of 16 or 17. It's an enormous task. Really.
Well, does it mean that the magnitude of the problem is such that we should not try to find a solution?
But we are not speaking, we're not even speaking of the solutions to the problem. If a solution was offered, like the guest that's calling in tonight stated, now, this is really radical, and it's a beautiful idea. Close the schools for 1 year. I mean, for the summer, and orient your teachers and just teach them to read for a solid year. Forget about
Mr. Hanna.
It's impossible.
Mr. Hanna, I'm sorry, but time has run out on us. Thank you so much for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
Sonny, thank you so very much for being our guest tonight
thank
on Night
you,
Call.
Dale.
This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Shields and guest, famed author of The Affluent Society, John Kenneth Galbraith. What can we do about the problem of military power? Is it and must it be unlimited? Or can the citizens of a democracy, asks Galbraith, curb the military's instinct for disaster? How can we control the military with John Kenneth Galbraith? Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions on Night Call.